us among the incumbent local exchange carriers, AT&T, TCI. Now there's talk in today's paper of a possible Deutsche Telekom Italia merger. Some suggest that on the international plane, there will be a handful of major carriers, of major global competitors, and one perhaps should likely assume that U.S.-based firms are going to be the leaders. Practically speaking, though, even though we think there's a lot of competition internationally, there still are a number of FCC restrictions and regulations regarding levels of foreign direct investment in U.S. telecommunications industry. There are also some restrictions on such arcane things as submarine cable landing licenses, rights to engage in facility-based competition. We are under a WTO agreement. We have to open up. But maybe I'll ask Paul to address the issue. Is the FCC gradually going to phase out existing restrictions on the activities of foreign-based carriers and their competitive access to the U.S. market? And will that promote competition?
I'd like to say the answer is yes, and that certainly seems to be the trend. I don't think it's going nearly fast enough. There still seems to be some distrust in Washington. It's not necessarily centered in the FCC, I will add, of foreign carriers. The agency tried to streamline, which is FCC bureaucraties to deregulation, our process for granting certificates of public interest, convenience, and necessity on the international telecommunications routes. And what we wanted to do is simply set it up as a situation where a carrier could come in and apply for it, and it would be futurely granted, and we could deny it subsequently if we decided that it was necessary. That was at least the idea floated inside the agency. Well, we received a lot of opposition to that plan from the Department of Defense and Department of Justice. FBI and other agencies came in saying that, well, they really wanted to have a shot at reviewing these telecommunications grants of authority in advance. And it struck us as extraordinary that terrorists would go through the effort of actually getting a license from the FCC before doing something. Maybe they have good attorneys in Washington.
I represent the jurors.
But I can't help but comment just a second on the merger aspect involved. And I think a lot of people are talking mergers in all spheres, not just in the international sphere, obviously, but also the domestic companies that propose mergers. And I think what has to be recalled here in the first instance is that the stock market is swollen right now. The companies have a lot of cash on hand, and it makes sense in that instance to buy other companies. It just makes sound economic sense. We're seeing it in every sector of the economy, not just the telecommunications. So it has, the people who point to the act as being some great failure because of the merger of these companies aren't recognizing that there are mergers going on in every sector. Energy, banking, just to name a couple, military, aircraft. I mean, you name your industry and there are major mergers going on. Unfortunately, companies in the telecommunications industry have a second level of review beyond antitrust review. And this is rather unfortunate because it's as important as we all think telecommunications is, and believe me, I think it is, it's hard to say that it's more important than energy, for example, or national defense. And yet, the mergers of companies involved in those industries go through a rigorous antitrust review conducted by the Department of Justice or Federal Trade Commission, and not secondarily by another specialized agency who tries to extract things from those companies. Unfortunately, that is what's going on in the context of telecommunications merger reviews. And right now, we have, of course, the FCC, a proposed merger by two regional operating companies, and it's being subjected to extraordinary scrutiny, well outside what we believe is the authority given to us in the Communications Act. The basis for our review of these mergers is twofold. One is under the Clayton Act. We have affirmative authority to review these mergers. And it requires, actually, the merger is considered granted, and the FCC can actually that's actually not correct. It's considered to be granted if the FCC is unable to block it in court. The other authority under which we actually review the merger, because we have not yet exercised our FLIC Act authority, is to scrutinize the transfer of wireless licenses from one company to another. So in the case of, for example, SBC and Ameritech, we are scrutinizing the proposed transfer of wireless licenses from Ameritech to the control of SBC. But in the review of the transfer of wireless licenses, we're looking into areas wholly unrelated to the wireless license transfers themselves. We are looking at, for example, competition in the wireline market. And in fact, we've even amazingly raised concerns about whether or not we would be able to effectively regulate the new merged entity as being a reason to block it. This, of course, is not in accordance with any known principle of antitrust law. It just seems to be a concern on the part of some regulators that we might lose some power if these companies are to actually consummate their merger. In any case, lastly, on the international mergers, we had a serious issue with the merger of MCI and WorldCom, whereby the European Union actually demanded that MCI divest itself of its internet access assets prior to agreeing to the merger. But also, it was not just a matter of the assets being held in Europe, which would have been fine. That certainly is within the European Union's control. The demand was actually placed on MCI's assets also in the United States, and we found that to be quite an outrage that our antitrust authorities would cede this kind of power to extraterritorial regulators.
Yes.
Mergers very quickly, because as a practitioner, I deal with this all the time. We represent SBC and GTE, and represent Maxell, in fact, in the merger with SBC. It is excruciating trying to get a merger through the FCC. It is an enormous undertaking, an enormous process. It takes an extremely long time to work through it all. Speaking as a practitioner, I see it as largely the effort, the process, is largely duplicative of the antitrust department, except that you get what it's got redeemed in a much shorter time than you get approval by the FCC. But the other thing you come away with, one mentioned Let's Make a Deal before, Let's Make a Deal is played nearly every day of the week, it seems to me, over the FCC with regard to these mergers. What happens is, and Bill Atlantic NYIAX is the first one, they went and took the applications to the FCC. What they came away with was a grant. But the grant had attached to it 17 pages of conditions, largely having to do, as I recall, and it's been a while since I've looked at it, the sort of interconnection issues that we were talking about before. In other words, related to a social or a policy goal that the FCC wanted to come up with, the result that they wanted to come up with, but wholly unrelated or largely unrelated to the any issues involving merger. That is now the paradigm for every merger. And you see it not just in large mergers, but where it really gets excruciating is in small mergers. I had one that dealt with as a wireless company. It took, I actually had been, when it was first acquired, I'd been there too. It got through the FCC and the statutory minimum of time, there were no objections to it, and was granted by a one paragraph public notice. The second time around, 2 years later, it was a months-long process of the commission disgorging various competitive information from this company. This is after an early Hart-Scott-Rodino evaluation, by the way, or approval. And it was resulted then in a 26-page order out of the commission saying, lo and behold, there's no problem with this merger. It is an excruciating process and something I hope will be helpful.
Yes,
Senator?
Can I get a word in on this? I think I agree with what's been said. There is a new Harvard study by two professors over at the business school who point out that 50% of all mergers essentially don't work. They either break apart or the shareholder value is not increased. And there are actually more new companies coming online now proportionate than there ever have been in terms of mergers. So it, it takes the point of view that there, even though we have a lot of newspaper headlines about mergers, that proportionally they are not significant as some have been in the past. Now, in terms of telecom companies and international competition, big companies, there's going to be something I think that's going to happen. That is, we have now Global Crossing laying fiber optic cable, and several other companies doing the same thing with a huge valuation. I think the same thing is going to happen that happened with the spectrum. We're going to find a great drop in the price of moving data across the ocean, and this is going to mean that smaller companies can compete. Small, nimble companies can get in on it much more so. Gary Winnick and his group, they're worth billions now, because if I were advising them, I'd say cash in, because with all the competition, in a year or two, it might become very cheap to send that data across the ocean. Also, I just got on the board of directors of a small company in Minneapolis, which has a multiplexer, which supposedly you can move four times as much data on fiber optics as you can now. The chairman says, if this works, we'll be rich. But if it doesn't work, be sure you get your D&O insurance in place. But the point is, we're on the verge, I think, of having a great liberation of being able to move things across oceans because of what Global Crossing is doing and all the cable that's being laid on the ocean and the satellite, the movement of information, at least. And I think that in 2 or 3 years, it's going to become very cheap to move things. So that's going to help small companies compete internationally and not let the Deutsche Telekoms and the AT&Ts and so forth control the ocean, so to speak.
Quick, Jim Casserly, Chief of Staff to Commissioner Ness, I think you may want to have a word.
Well, I guess if I wanted to say that I hope that if this panel lasts 2 whole hours, we'd probably get one person to say something nice about the FCC, and we did get there. I was surprised that it was you, Paul. I was delighted.
You're so negative
on mergers, this is the source of an abundant debate, and given the time, I'm going to just encourage you all to, you know, if this interests you, visit the Commission's website. You'll see people have had their say on this at some length. The views of 4 commissioners are stated about the Commission's role in this process are stated in the MCI WorldCom and AT&T Teleport orders. The views of Commissioner Firstgut-Roth are also explained at length in his dissents, or concurrences, I guess, on those. But the characterization of the Commission's goal in merger reviews as, quote, trying to extract things, close quote, is entirely incorrect. The notion that our only jurisdictional handle is wireless is also incorrect, see Section 214. The notion that our fear is that we will lose power is just wrong. The Bell Atlantic NYIAX order was the product of a prior commission, and Commissioner Ness was party to it, but none of the other commissioners from that one survived. But what the commission found there was not, geez, wouldn't it be nice to impose a bunch of conditions on this merger, but rather, absent these conditions, the commission would have been compelled to determine that this transaction was not, the transfer of these licenses and construction permits was not in the public interest. So the commission has never taken the view that it should take a good merger and make it better by sticking a bunch of conditions on it. Conditions have come into play only where a party recognized that its transaction was in danger of being adjudged to be to fail to meet the public interest standard, and then they found a way to bring it into the positive rather than negative zone. If I can take just 30 seconds to correct 3 or 4 of the other things. You say we're trying to...
You're using the word elaborate.
Says we're trying to take over the jurisdiction, displace the Federal Trade Commission and consumer protection. In fact, the Federal Trade Commission's authorizing statute expressly ousts them from jurisdiction over the common carriers that we're trying to deal with. I heard that our interconnection order was should have been intended to regulate the local companies, not nuke them. But the fact is, their service is good, their prices are reasonable, their stocks are strong, and their earnings are terrific. I've heard that we were regulating up, not regulating down, and yet There's no economic regulation, no control of prices for long distance, for information services, for customer premises equipment. We got rid of it for wireless a few years back, CLEX. We had a proposal for how the, even the incumbent local exchange carriers could get out from under that. It has not yet been adopted. It was interfered with by the Supreme Court decision. But so in a number of these cases, I think you're just not getting the whole story, and I hope you will visit the website, engage yourselves in the debate, and familiarize yourselves with all sides. Finally, on the point of follow the law. Paul, I took the same oath you took. My boss took the same oath your boss took. We are as committed to following the law as you are. No one has, we may read it differently from time to time, and so it seems. But because I disagree with your reading of the law, I don't call you lawless. I would think it would be a good contribution to reasoned discourse if you could observe the same courtesy.
I just have to jump in really to rise at least figuratively to support Jim Cassidy, at least in a procedural, not a substantive sense about the voices being heard. I don't know who's right or wrong, but I think I don't know where the professor is coming from your remarks as far as who you might testify for. But I mean, clearly, I'm not trying to be pejorative, man. So I'm saying, you know, Bob Heads, as he represents Arbox, and Paul Meister's boss is going to argue that the boss doesn't represent the pro Arbox position. And Senator Pressler, on the whole, I think, was regarded as an Arbox supporter. Or at least furthering the positions of the Arbox. I think on that level, we're not going to have an argument, and I don't think Paul's going to argue that. You put up a chart of what the Arbox are saying and what other people in the industry are saying. Your commissioner related rather clearly on one side of that. But I think there's just a lot to what Jim is saying in the sense that this is a huge, huge debate, and there's a lot more to be said all around. And it's interesting because since I've left the Arbonne world, I find myself dealing mostly with the investment world. And it's a whole different sort of outlook where Wall Street is trying as best they can to get through the inside the beltway spin of all the characters. So it's very interesting. But Jim, I just want to say that.
Any more questions? We're approaching the, the reaching hour. Yes, the rebuttal.
I just want to say one thing positive about the SEC. I didn't realize there was a big negative about the SEC. As a practitioner, you get pretty cynical about such a dealing with the commission sometimes. The original question actually had to do with the World Trade Organization. Commission is a terrific job in implementing that. In fact, before that, was going down that road anyway, you know, opening up John, and I thought aggressive and regular reading of the statute, knowing that U.S. markets at least to join the investment.
Paul, are you and your boss law-abiding, lawless, or something, or third category?
Well, Reed Hunt said that we were cranky, lawless, and unlawyerly, which we took as a compliment from him. Look, Section 214 of the Act, by the way, which Jim recognizes, he's absolutely right. There is other authority there besides the transfer of wireless and licenses under Title III. Section 214 authorizations are fairly few and far between. There are far fewer of those than there are wireless license transfers. And so to make the record complete, he is absolutely right. He does not get around the fact that, for example, Mobil holds more wireless licenses than does Ameritech. And we're not reviewing Exxon Mobil, but we're reviewing FCC Ameritech. Figure that out. As to following the law, we're all lawyers here, we're all big people, or you're soon going to be lawyers. that's what we're all about, and it would be very hard for me to do my job or for my boss to do his job without pointing out what he believes to be extra legal excursions by this agency. And so it's not a matter of comedy to point out that there's that we believe that they are not acting lawfully, just doing our jobs. And we are lawyers, and if you don't argue on behalf, vigorously on behalf of your client when the other side is acting what you believe to be extra legally, then you're simply not doing your job.
Well, now that we've resolved all internal positions on the commission, any more questions from the floor? Yes. Back there.
Well, I just have a couple of quick questions for you. This one is real quick. Who is your client?
Gerald Fershkagerov, Commissioner of the SEC.
Okay. And, I just want to get, and I'm not sure I heard an explicit answer or really address this issue explicitly, the morning issue of the Mindspring or other people wanting access to the cable plant. I mean, is your commissioner's position just hands off? This is an example of, you know, no regulation, or might this be an example where regulation might in fact help consumers have more choices, which I would think would be sort of like the libertarian goal of, you know, one of the things of not having any regulation is to have let the consumers have more choices. This might be, is this an example where regulation might facilitate more consumer choices, or which way would you come on that one?
Money. But we lack legal authority to implement such a regulation.
It would be laws.
It would be laws.
It would be laws.
Question up there.
Hopefully it's a quick one. There was at one point controversy over the extent of state utility commissions to assess universal service fees based on interstate phone calls as opposed to really interstate or local. Has there been any resolution on that in the last few months?
Reciprocal compensation, which I think is what you're talking about. Yeah, the decision was to describe internet as jurisdictionally interstate. That was the decision, but the commission, I think, tried to have it both ways by not upsetting previous state decisions, which found it to be intrastate. And in those regimes, as I understand it, are going to continue. But you know a lot more about that than I do.
What the FCC said, of course, was that it was a decision that has to do only with reciprocal compensation, not with respect to access charges. So the question is whether or not a CELA, for example, the market, CELA could be an ISP as well, whether a CELA has a right to reciprocal compensation from an ILEC when they terminate the ILEC's telephone call to an ISP. That issue then gets characterized as a question of whether the call itself is interstate, because if it's interstate, then reciprocal compensation doesn't apply. But I think the long-term implication is that you take that precedent characterization of an interstate call, and you sort of march over to the access issue, which involves the universal service problem. There's no universal service problem involved in it. If I understood you.
I may have been looking at the mic. I may have had a mic in this room. I was asking more in terms not of internet, but there was litigation going on last summer, as I understood in various areas, over whether or not when state utilities commissions were funding their conditional velocity universal service fund, whether or not they could go ahead and also assess charges based on the interstate service fees for regular phones.
I wasn't sure.
Yeah, that's quite.
Yeah. Using the interstate revenues, I think.
The reverse issue is currently pending before the Fifth Circuit. That is an FCC rule that says that contributions for the schools and library support mechanisms may be based on the contributions of interstate carriers
shall be based on their intra and interstate revenues. That decision is currently pending before the Fifth Circuit and awaiting a decision. I'm not aware of any federal court litigation involving a state commission decision to base the contributions of intrastate carriers on interstate revenue, but one would assume that those would be logically intertwined and that the Fifth Circuit's decision might well answer both questions.
Yes.
I have a question stemming from the Supreme Court's recent decision in the Iowa Utilities case, which established that the FCC had jurisdiction to promulgate its pricing regulations. But I think the merits of these are still going to be a subject of a lot of debate and litigation. And I was wondering, just curious kind of what your impressions are of the claims against that, both as an economic and a legal matter, on a substantive basis. And also, a number of scholars have raised that possibility that this long-run methodology might constitute a regulatory taking. This has been the subject of a lot of recent literature. And in combination with this, since these long-run views really undermine some of the universal service subsidy program that's in the Act, and I recognize that the Act wants a longer period of time for universal service subsidies to be addressed, but do you think that perhaps these should have been addressed together, or perhaps getting the subsidy beforehand? Because a lot of the underlying problem or perceived problem with this pricing methodology seems to be the subsidy.
Well, I might just say that I think the Iowa case was a big shift in power, and I'm not pro ARPA for full long distance. I try to be right down the middle on the bill, but the RBOC really, as a practical matter, control the state PUCs in many ways, not because just because they're there, they have many people, and they're raising the scoutmaster and so forth in the local town. Whereas the FCC, I think, is more oriented towards the long distance companies, if we could say that. So I think it was a great shift in power away from the RBOC in one sense. Now, what impact that will have. You see, I think the RBOC are much weaker in the current state of things than they look. And they're big companies, granted, but they are in the defensive. And they and in that Iowa case, I think they lost a great power base as a practical matter. But that was one result of it.
May I follow up on that?
Yes.
In two ways. One is, if you would comment on the Iowa case in more general terms of federalism, you just spoke of it as if these issues were RBOC versus the interstate carriers. But in another way, of course, the issue is just as much a matter of state versus federal jurisdiction. And I'd be curious about your thoughts about that.
Yeah.
The second question, you want to do that one first, and then I'll ask for both at the same time. The second one really is that half a dozen or 10 years ago, the court came down with a pretty clear statement that the Act respected and, in fact, confirmed that states had jurisdiction over intrastate rates. As you put through the bill, that was debated extensively, and there were more or less language about whether to expand or trim or affirm or reject that language. But I at least thought a fair reading of the way you came out was that you weren't going to change it one way or the other. And I was, I think, among others, surprised that the Supreme Court thought you had changed it. I wonder whether you were surprised that the Supreme Court thought you changed it.
Well, I was a little bit. You know, Justice Scalia said, he had that one sentence, he said that this is a terribly unclear sentence. It's about a 50-word sentence. I almost jumped out of my seat. The guards would have thrown me out. Then shouted that God, there were about 60 people who added adverbs to that sentence before we could negotiate it out. So,
response to that $100,000 in adverbs.
But I still remember well when that bill was under consideration. Senator Dole was running for president, and he wanted the support of the governors, and they all came in and said we want the states to, our state PUCs to have this, and Clinton did the same thing on the other side, you know. And so I was a little bit surprised the way the Supreme Court ruled, but I think it's a great shift of power in terms of federalism, and it's a in terms of the state's rights, it's gone the other way, I guess.
I was sorry, I wasn't terribly surprised by the jurisdictional decision. I mean, it was pretty straightforward. The 96 Act had been incorporated into the 34 Act, and the 34 Act gave the Commission the authority to promulgate rules to reach the goals of the Act. So it was a pretty straightforward decision from a jurisdictional standpoint. But it is that. This is certainly not constitutional. Federalism in any sense. It's simply an interpretation distinction.
I just might add, the partial dissent of Justice Breyer didn't emphasize so much the federalism aspect as much as sort of the economic aspect, whether these particular unbundled local elements, whether it made economic sense to require that all of these elements be unbundled. But that's just an aside. I take your point that it was seen by some in advance as having quasi-federalism implications. Questions? Yes.
I'm sorry. Can I just say something about that? To me, the biggest implication of the case is, again, remaining a lot of questions to Jim and Paul and others at the SEC about these unbundled network elements. It creates, again, as I was saying, a tremendous uncertainty about when, whatever, that's going to be decided, and when we're going to be able to decide what does our Black has to do, what Black has to do.
I think I'm going to have to cut off the questioning. Suddenly people, I think, are waking up in late afternoon, but we do have a reception and the hour is late. But hey, one more question.
I got a quick one. I'm not remembering where that Paul before. I worked for a summer at the White House, the National Economic Council, and that's when you were at Intel. And you were with the Internet Access Coalition, or that was like the industry consortium.
Here it comes. You're going to point out any
of this. No.
You said then.
Well, no, I don't know what your current position is now, but back then you were very pro, understandably so, sub-loop unbundling. I think it's specifically in the case of, DSL, a lot of acronyms. If you ever served by a remote terminal, then you need to get the CLEX into there to, if you want a vigorous DSL competition there. Now, what is, I guess, your current view on that, and what is the reality of something like that passing at the FCC? Or is that a congressional handoff, or just what you're worried about?
Okay, well, I question the definition of the word subloop, and there's no controlling legal authority. We just issued a further notice of proposed rulemaking addressing what the commission has called line sharing, which is a form of subleak unbundling. It has to do more with sharing the same frequency sharing, exactly, unbundling the higher frequencies of a copper loop. The thought of getting at truly a geographical subloop is something that, while at Intel, we believe to be very important, given that many of the broadband technologies are designed for copper as opposed to fiber. And if you are running fiber to a outside the central office switch to a remote terminal, it would be impossible to use those technologies. It may be impossible. Right now, we're considering on remand, as we've just discussed, the unbundled network elements and the definitions thereof. It is possible in that context that we could once again address whether or not a subloop is meets the necessary and imperative standard. If you read that case, though, Justice Scalia's opinion sets a pretty high bar for what is there. Now, this is not to say where the commission is going to come out. I'm having a hard time predicting. Maybe Jim's closer to it, perhaps, but I'm not sure exactly where the five commissioners will come out on this. It's not an easy decision at this point.
I'll make a prediction. They will not come out together. Along the lines of, as I said, Senator Pressler, that it's been great act of communications lawyers, that in fact the decision will be appealed. I suspect in a year or two, or however many, we still won't know exactly what the network outcome will be.
Yeah, that's all true. And one last thing I'd like to say, thank you guys for being so patient with us Washingtonians today. I know it's Saturday here, it's actually night down here. So thanks for being so patient.
Well, thank you. Like, I'm like the old Soviet politicians. I'm not applauding myself. I'm applauding the panelists. Professor Glenn Robinson, who had to leave, his twin Bob Pettit, Paul Meisner, from Chief of Staff to Commissioner First Scott Roth, and Senator Pressler. And we're honored that you were able to come and give us your time. And I think we haven't answered the questions, but we've concluded that there's plenty of work for future telecommunications lawyers. So you're going to have plenty of hours to bill if you enter the field. And there's a reception immediately following. Thank you.
I'm going to go to the next one.